Here we go.
Neutron, proton, mass defect. Lyrical oxidation, your irrelevant mass spectrograph, your electron volt, atomic energy erupting as I get all open on betatrons, gamma rays, thermal cracking, cyclotron, any and every mic you're on, transuranium, if y'all was uranium, molecule spontaneous combustion, pow. Law of definite proportion gain, ink weight, I'm every element around.
Welcome to Spark Science, where we explore stories of human curiosity. I'm Regina Barber DeGraff. I teach physics and astronomy at Western Washington University, and I'm here with my co-host, Jordan Baker.
I am Jordan Baker. I do not do anything at Western Washington University. Nope. I have no degrees.
Have you ever been on campus, even?
Oh, yeah. Remember in band when we had the
San Juan
Music Educators Association competition?
Nice side there. How's the upfront improving going?
Upfront's going well.
Good?
Yeah.
How's the musical going? I know I asked you that last time.
I actually went and saw it, and it was amazing.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's different every night.
Yeah. To see these people like making up songs that, like, musicals are rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed, and these people are just making it up on the spot. It was incredible.
Yeah. And you haven't gone up there yet for the part
of
the musical?
No, still just during practices.
Do people use, like, part of their life, like things that they like to do kind of in improv ever?
I mean, it's a lot easier than making something up, is using your life experiences. Right. And some of my, like, horrible life experiences I've applied in a scene, and it got huge laughs because my life is sometimes super ridiculous.
Right. So do you ever use your scuba diving stories in your improv?
I actually, not scuba diving stories, but I'll, like, there's this incident with scuba diving. I'm like, get your BCD, and then nobody knows what a BCD is, so I have to explain it.
Well, Jordan, you're in luck because today we have Captain Nate Schwark, and he's a diving safety officer at Shannon Point Marine Center. And we want to welcome him, so...
Thank
How's
you.
It going?
Great.
Do you know what that means, what Jordan just said?
You bet. A BCD. What buoyancy compensator device.
Ah, like a balloon?
Kinda. Like, once you get down to the bottom, you're trying to find your neutral buoyancy, so you add air from your tank to try and get you to just float.
I should have you come to my physics class when we're talking about buoyancy.
Can I float?
Well, I mean, you can just, like, talk and, like, act it out in musical form.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, Captain Nate, thank you so much for coming. Can I call you Nate?
Sure.
Okay. Can you tell us something about your position at Shannon Point? And then after that, maybe tell us your life story, your whole life story, this whole show.
Easy. Piece of cake.
Like, 5 minutes.
So I work with a really good team of people at Shannon Point Marine Center, and Shannon Point is a facility of Western, so we support the scientists on main campus, and we have some resident scientists at the Marine Lab. So we're located in Anacortes, Washington, right next to the ferry terminal. If you've ever taken the ferry in Anacortes, you've been right next to our property. So it's a beautiful piece, about 80 acres. There's waterfront. There is no dock because Shannon Point is high energy, so that university actually owns slips in the marina, and that's where the research vessels are kept, in Skyline Marina.
Isn't it expensive to own slips in the marina?
Well, if you purchased them a long time ago, it's a lot better than it would be now. So
if I go back in time and buy them. Got it.
Right.
Yeah.
I wear three hats. So.
Or none today, though. This is radio, so.
My position is kind of split three ways, is what I mean by that. So yeah. I am the lead research vessel captain for the university vessels, and I share the operational duties of those vessels with two other wonderful individuals who, actually, one of them was here in Bellingham Bay today. He picked up some students. They did a really neat project looking at water quality in Bellingham Bay.
Awesome.
Some collaborations taking place with the LUMMI, or the Northwest Indian College. So you may have
seen... They're doing a lot of work. Right?
They are.
Yeah.
They are. You may have seen Research Vessel Magister at Fairhaven. Sometimes we come to that
dock. How big is this vessel?
Oh, it's huge. It's all of 38 feet.
Okay.
So, whoa!
Okay.
So we're not ocean going, but what we are is fast.
Right.
So we can head, you know, I can beat you to Anacortes. So if we race, you drive, I'm operating the vessel, I'll win.
Did you take the boat
no,
here
I didn't.
Today?
I didn't.
Because that would have been the best story.
That would have been awesome.
No wonder you were early. You took the boat.
Yeah, so that's one of my hats, is kind of maintaining those vessels, operating those vessels, keeping them mission ready.
Okay.
The second hat, and the one that people like to talk about the most, it seems, is diving safety officer. I teach and train faculty, staff, students in scientific diving. And I'm the diving safety officer for the entire university. So anybody on campus that wants to use science as a tool to do their research, I help them get there and be able to turn them from a recreational diver who's thinking about, okay, I'm underwater, what do I need to do to stay alive, to that being second nature, and okay, I'm underwater, I'm a scientist, how do I get good data?
Wow.
And that's can be a fun, well, no, it's great. It's a fun process. I think you'd really enjoy it.
No, but we'll talk about Jordan would enjoy it. We'll talk more about my horrible phobias later, but what's your third hat?
I work as a marine technologist. We have lots of fun, interesting pieces of equipment that sometimes break, and I try to keep them running. Some instruments, well, we're mixing electricity and seawater, and that doesn't always work well.
Sounds great.
So, you know, instrumentation that's doing water quality measurements under the water, and there's electricity going down to make this thing work. It's communicating with the vessel real time, so we can see what's going on, and then we can actually capture water at different depths and bring it to the surface, and the oceanographers love this. It's fun stuff. So that's maintaining those types of instruments, instrumentation at the lab, the vessels, that's kind of the third hat that I wear.
Wow. So how did you get into diving to begin with? Like, have you always loved it? Like you were three years old diving.
I actually, September will be my 30th anniversary as a diver. So I started diving. I was 12-ish years old.
So I wasn't being ridiculous, is what you're telling me.
It has pretty much defined my life and my thought process for 30 years. I love it. I think about it a lot. I find myself still excited to learn new things and, you know, learn different aspects of diving. So, yeah, I really do enjoy it.
It's awesome.
So my phobia I was alluding to is that I don't like sea creatures at all. So, like, I haven't even snorkeled. I just don't want them near me. They have the upper hand, and they rule the ocean, and I don't want to be, you know, in there with them. I like pools, but I don't want to. So I couldn't even, get to those depths. But I should ease into it, shouldn't I? I should just,
well,
like,
an area with good visibility helps.
Right. So try Hawaii first or something.
And we can have good visibility here, but not always.
Right.
So
when's the best visibility?
Late winter, after the storms have kind of slowed down and we're not getting a ton of river input, and then before we get so much light that the plankton blooms.
Okay.
So there is a cycle where we can have amazing visibility, and it's gorgeous. The marine life here is spectacular. But it's not always easy to see. Sometimes you get underwater and you can only see 4 or 5 feet if you're lucky. So
yeah, I remember swimming in, I believe it was Lake Patton, and suddenly things started touching me like seaweed, and I was like, I'm done. I was like, no more.
Being able to see is a big part of getting over phobias.
I think it's a very evolutionary thing to be afraid of the dark, and and then in the water where you can drown and dark is... seems a bit much.
The ultimate.
Yeah.
I dive with my wife a lot every time we go on vacation, and she has a super big phobia about diving around here just because of the visibility. Everywhere else we go is usually like 80 foot of visibility, and, you know, 4 to 5 feet's not necessarily, you can't really swim away from something if it just, boom, all of a sudden it's in your face.
It's right there.
Yeah, that's crazy. For sure. So what exactly is scientific diving? Is it just what you just explained before, where it's you're just diving and taking data as well?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, it depends if you're thinking about what does the federal government define as scientific diving versus what the general population defines as scientific diving.
Okay. So what's the difference?
If you're employed to do that work, or employed to do diving or science underwater, then the federal government gets really excited about that because there's an employee-employer relationship. And so that kind of changes the activity from, say, recreational diving, where you're just out having fun.
Okay. So only if you're employed, then you might be doing scientific diving. But you could do other kinds of diving when you're employed, too. I mean, there's, like, you know, treasure hunters.
Archaeology would be...
Yeah. I like how you translate treasure hunter to archaeology. Yes.
So legitimate treasure hunting, I don't... Yeah, that's not really scientific diving.
But, right.
Certainly archaeology is. And some of the earliest scientific divers were, in fact, doing really cool archaeology.
Right. Treasures in a sense, you know, for the museum.
Yes,
yes. Down, down, down there in the sea. Down, down, down.
Spark Science is an all-volunteer run show, and if you'd like to help out, go to KMRE.org and click on the button Donate. I'm Regina Barber DeGraff, and today we are talking about scientific diving with Captain Nate Schwark. Well, I just finished the book Cryptonomicon, which is so long. It's like the longest book ever. Have you ever read it, Nate?
No. Okay. I feel like I should have, though.
No, there's tons of diving in that. And they actually go through the process of what happens to your body and how this guy, he's diving from a very, very deep place. And he actually comes up in these like water pockets that are still very deep. So he does it slowly so it doesn't affect his body too much. So can you explain that more to me? Like, what happens to the body? I think Jordan probably already knows all this stuff, but like, how far can you go? Why do people's eye blood vessels pop? I don't know.
Well, I try not to focus on those types of things, but...
My phobias. That's what I want the answer.
No, you're just going to encourage her.
Yeah, right. I'm still not going to go.
I feel like you're being influenced too much by popular media.
My uncle, he was scuba diving and his... blood vessels pop.
Recreational diving, scientific diving, most diving takes place from the surface to 120 feet. So we're not talking about that deep. When you
120
consider,
seems a bit...
Well, consider the ocean.
That's true. So, that's true.
That's nothing compared to what's out there in the ocean. We're looking at 3 atmospheres on average. So every 33 feet underwater is equivalent to 1 atmosphere of pressure.
Right.
And so right now in this room, we are under 1 atmosphere of pressure, and that's what our body is feeling. Right. And so you can double that by going to 33 feet, and you're actually feeling the effects of 2 atmospheres. And so that is kind of where all the cool physiology starts. And then, we could go on and on about how that affects your body. And
yeah, let's just go on, just a little bit.
Okay.
So what happens, for instance... What has happened to your body, Jordan? How far have you gone?
I've gone down to 90-ish feet. Yeah.
So I'm still what you were, Nate was saying, in the recreational range. So tell me physically how you felt, and then Nate maybe can talk a little bit about the science of that.
I don't know. For me, it's... I just have a really... It's like second nature almost. I don't really remember a whole lot of my training, as in like fear or anything, or how my body felt. Honestly, it's just second nature now. Yeah, well, I mean, like, once you get down there, you just want to focus on your breathing and just trying to move as slow as possible, conserve your air, and take in as much stuff as you can. That's basically my goal once I get down there.
Yeah.
One thing that is talked about quite a bit is nitrogen narcosis.
Right.
As, 90 feet, you're probably starting to feel a little bit narked. Which is how we term.
Okay.
And this has been described as being a little bit drunk, a little bit euphoric. And I noticed that when I'm at that depth, I am incapable of taking in too much at once. So I have a gauge, a set of gauges, a console of gauges. And one of the gauges is my depth gauge. One of the gauges is my air pressure. And so I'm at, 90 feet, and I'm like, I need to check my air. So I'll pull the gauge up and I'll look at my air pressure. Oh, good, I'm great. And then I'm like, I really need to check my depth. And so then I'll pull the gauge up and look at my depth gauge. And I'm like, that's good. But I'm incapable of pulling that console up and looking at both at the same time. And so it's just that seems to be how it manifests itself in me. I don't really feel that euphoric, so to speak.
Right.
But I notice that I'm not quite firing on all cylinders at depth. And there's ways to overcome that.
Okay, so how?
One of the ways we do that is using enriched air nitrox. Nitrogen narcosis is the result of having a high partial pressure of nitrogen in your bloodstream. So you've got, right now we're breathing, 70-some% nitrogen and 21% oxygen.
Okay. I didn't know those percentages exactly, but thank you.
And under pressure, the partial pressure of nitrogen is much greater than what's in your bloodstream, and so nitrogen begins to enter your bloodstream, and that physiologically is causing narcosis.
And the symptoms of narcosis are
euphoria and being a little bit drunk.
The
deeper you go, the worse it gets often, and until you get too deep, then you'll probably pass out. But
okay
so one of the ways they combat that is reduce the amount of nitrogen in your breathing mix.
Okay.
And so you'll probably have heard of enriched air nitrox or nitrox divers. And so these are divers who have taken an additional training on how to use this enriched gas. And so you reduce the nitrogen, increase the oxygen, hopefully reducing your the effects of narcosis. Oh.
Does that allow you to stay down at the bottom longer?
It does. And
you seem hesitant.
Well, you know, so then you're pushing your limits even more. So the way we do it at the university is I like to not use it to stay longer. I like to use it to be safer.
Right. So that's to be more sane and
right,
not drunk.
Right.
So the bends, is that the same thing? Is that what people call the bends? What are the bends?
Sure. So
I hear these words and
so
I just want to know what they are.
You've got this nitrogen in your bloodstream again.
Mm-hmm.
And the bends starts to really become a problem as you come up.
Okay.
And so all this nitrogen is dissolved into your bloodstream. And as you come up, it wants to come out of solution. And it'll form little bubbles in your capillaries, in your veins,
wow,
and your arteries.
That sounds dangerous.
And a lot of these get washed out by your lungs. And
okay,
so if you trace the path of blood through the body, you know, returning blood from the capillaries is going to the lungs, and the lungs will wash out some of those nitrogen bubbles. But every once in a while, especially if you're not following the diving tables or your computer, a bubble will lodge itself someplace and start to give you troubles. And so paralysis, you know, if you have a limb that feels like it's starting to go to sleep, so that blood flow is restricted, that means it's maybe there's a bubble there and maybe you're going to have trouble. And that's not as bad as if you get one of these bubbles in your brain, because then you can end up with a stroke or
right,
much worse symptoms.
And that's why in this book, this person was trying to breathe at different depths so
yes,
he could get you, oh, okay,
and allow some of that nitrogen to kind of slowly come to the pressure of the current depth. And so if you take your time and allow the bloodstream to go back to what the ambient is, wherever you're at currently, then you can then go up a little bit more,
right,
and then allow it to diffuse out again. They also use different gases. So instead of just high mixes of oxygen, you can throw in helium. So if you've ever seen fun movies where the divers are kind of talking like they just sucked on a helium balloon,
yes,
that's because they're adding helium to that mix to reduce the amount of nitrogen in there.
Okay. This is super interesting. We're going to take a break. And then when we come back, we're going to talk about the actual science that is being conducted with the scientific diving.
Great.
All right.
This one's called Stella Was a Diver and She's Always Down.
If you're just joining us, this is Spark Science. I'm Jordan Baker.
I'm Regina Barber DeGraff, and today we are talking about scientific diving with Captain Nate Schwark.
So how does somebody like me, with just my initial open water diver certification, start to get into scientific diving? What other classes would I have to take?
Usually, it's best if you've had recreational training through rescue diver. So traditionally, you start out diving and it's called open water, or you know, the entry level course. And then there's like an advanced course where you learn some different techniques, maybe do a night dive or a deep dive.
Dive sounds terrifying.
Oh, it's awesome.
Sorry.
And then kind of go into rescue skills. And a lot of this is self-rescue. So you're starting to think more about keeping yourself out of trouble than really trying to rescue somebody else. It's basically self-rescue techniques. And so how do I keep myself from becoming the next statistic is one of the key things of that course. And so once you've kind of reached that level as a recreational diver, then it's quite easy to transition into becoming a scientific diver and learn about what is needed to do that.
Is there a need for more scientific divers to take data?
Sure. Always. And a lot of it depends on, you know, what cool projects are taking place at the time. So it'll wax and wane. Like at Western, we have some diving scientists that do cool research.
We'll get to that in a little bit.
Okay.
I realize that we probably should talk about the history of diving first. Do you want to do that?
Sure.
Let's talk about history of scientific diving.
I love the history of scientific diving. Yeah. It's a really cool topic. It's a neat interest of mine. So I was going to talk about, you know, where did scientific diving come from?
Yeah.
And if we look back, Alexander the Great in 332 BC was lowered into the sea to observe marine life. And so he
did he do everything?
He was great.
Yeah. He was great.
That was the whole point.
But this was kind of a bell type thing, you know, he got lowered into a breathing bell. And a lot of early dives were bell type or breath hold type diving.
So they would just have like an air pocket.
Right.
Okay.
And get lowered down. And as you're going down, that air pocket would get smaller and smaller, unless it's getting pumped in from the surface trying to match pressure. But it sounds exciting. I'd like to try that sometime, maybe to moderate depths.
Right. To that 30 feet we were talking about.
Yes. But the first real recorded scientific dives was made by Henry Milne Edwards. He was from Sicily, and it was around 1844. And he used a commercial diving suit. It was a new invention. And he went to a depth of 25 feet. So he's kind of attributed as the first modern scientific diver.
And what kind of data was he taking, or what was he
Mostly observation.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just making sure he didn't die, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is a new technology, you know, and I just...
Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody knew what was down there, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it was...
That's a good point.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody knows what's down there still.
In a lot of places, that is true. So in the early 1900s, there was a lot of hard hat diving commercially. And so there was a few scientists that used this technology as a tool for their research. But not that many. But, you know, there was commercial diving that took place. In the United States, one of the first scientific divers was this guy named W.H. Longley, and it was around 1910, and he's best known for the first color underwater photographs in National Geographic.
Yeah.
I actually brought that to show you guys.
Yeah, I was looking through.
I was looking at those pictures, yeah, and what I want to do for this show, I'll probably post these pictures for our listeners to look at, but they are amazing. When you say that they were made in, like, 1910, that's...
Yes.
That's ridiculous. And I mean, our listeners will be looking at this while we're saying this, but...
Prior to this, nobody, you know, the general population had never seen colors that were underwater and the beauty of the life underwater. And in order to get this, it was huge amounts of flash powder that would explode underwater in time with the cameras in order
get
proper lighting to do this. So that sounds pretty fun. And you know, it was around this time that universities began using scientific diving. So there was University of Miami in the early 1900s conducted scientific diving in a river right next to campus. So they actually had students put on diving helmets and go down in the river. So it was air was being pumped into the helmet, and they could observe
with a hose
marine life underwater. And so there was a long tradition of education going along with scientific diving. But it wasn't really until Cousteau and Emily Gagan developed the Aqualung around 1942 that scientific diving really began to take off.
The song from Jethro Tull?
Wait, what song?
Aqualung.
Oh. Yeah,
I guess it's an old song, and we're the same age, so
we
should have got that reference.
We're like 4 months apart.
If you've ever seen the Bond movie, Thunderball?
Yeah, no, I think I say one, I just watched it, but it was seriously like 7 years ago. But
I just saw
that. But yeah, there's a lot of diving in that.
Yeah, so the diving equipment they're using in that is really similar. It's the two-hose regulator, you know, so you got these hoses that come around, and there's great shots of James Bond cutting these with the knife and then bubbles coming out, and they have to go to the surface. So.
And they're shooting stuff.
Gun
arrow thingies. Oh, yeah. Yes.
Gun arrow thingy?
What are those called? I don't know.
Spear guns.
Spear guns.
Yes.
It's a gun arrow. It's a different brand. But
as the adolescent Nate, that this was his favorite movie. So
right. Adolescent Nate. He's gone.
And maybe it's a secret shame that adult Nate still likes it too.
No, my husband loves those movies, and he would constantly talk about Jacques Cousteau, and my husband loves the ocean and like fish and just is obsessed with all that stuff. Wanted to be an ichthyologist, is now a lawyer. but big difference.
Right, sometimes we have to compromise. Yeah.
Sometimes we have to compromise.
It's probably easier to find employment as a lawyer.
It is not. People don't know this. The legal market is flooded.
Really?
Yeah, it's terrible. Huh. Yeah, but well, anyway.
Maybe he should specialize in like diving.
He was thinking about
a diving lawyer.
Well, hey, if you have any connections, he would totally do it. He actually really loved maritime law and this idea where people could be stateless. Do you know about this? If you were born on a ship during a certain time in our history, you only had citizenship if you were born physically in that country, but now you're on a ship, you're stateless. You don't have citizenship.
And then you don't have to pay taxes? Or how does that work?
you have to go to a country that will accept you as a citizen, and that can be hard.
Do you have to beg?
You do.
Please accept me.
Yeah, but he said the other day, he was like, I got it. I have my future career. I'll do space law.
Nice. Yeah. Very cool.
All right, sorry, back to this. Jacques Cousteau.
Yeah, Cousteau. Cousteau did a lot of things, and most of it was for cool TV shows.
Yes, he did.
That a lot of our generation grew up on.
But he did great science outreach.
He did. Yeah. And he's actually was an early scientific diver. He used his aqualung to excavate a large amphora mound off the island of Grand Calais near Marseille. And these amphoras were these ancient vases.
It's a vase.
There's actually some great pictures of him, you know, adding air to these things, you know, hundreds of years old.
And then have them float him up.
Shooting them up to the surface.
What was the name of that book?
The Living Sea.
Living Sea.
Yes. There's great. Wonderful book if you want to hear about early diving from Cousteau's perspective. So in the United States, it was this guy named Conrad Limbaugh who introduced this new technology of Cousteau's to the scientific world. And so he was a graduate student at Scripps in California, and he started using this new invention as a tool to do his research.
Yeah.
And Conrad Limbaugh became the first, you know, diving safety officer. He's attributed with actually teaching other people how to use this tool for science. One of the cool things that I was going to talk about is early diving in Washington State. So what about our state? What about right here? Who was doing this early on?
I heard, and I'm sure you had tons of favorite diving places, but I heard Cousteau really liked this area.
Yeah, he's on record as rating it as one of his favorite spots in the world.
Of course he did. He's awesome.
Duh.
it must be cool then, right?
Yeah.
So in 1955, there was this guy from Seattle named Bill High and Tony Novotny. They actually used diving to help set up some of the early salmon ladders and some of the things taking place on this creek for, you know, development of dams. So he's, in our state, kind of what I would call the earliest scientific diver. He was followed by, actually, my major professor, Larry McCloskey, did his first scientific dives at Rosario Beach in 1957.
Where's that? I grew up in Washington. Been here almost all my life, but where's that?
Do you know where Fidalgo Island meets Whidbey Island?
No.
Deception Pass?
Yes.
So that area.
It's like ding, 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 yes. Okay. Yeah. So did you grow up in Washington?
I did not. I've only been here, I think, 20 years.
Okay. So. Where did you learn to dive?
I learned in a lake in the Midwest.
Oh. Yeah. we're so mean. Oh.
Yeah. And I saw a fish. I wrote that in my dive log. I saw a fish.
Really?
But it must have been cool. It got me hooked.
What part of the Midwest?
I grew up in Nebraska.
Okay.
And we actually had to travel north to a big reservoir, and that's where we learned how to dive. I can't remember the name of the reservoir.
So
I've actually heard of a lot of people in the Midwest diving in reservoirs and quarries and stuff like that. It's crazy.
So, not to be mean, but do you like it here better?
There's probably a little more stuff to look at.
There is.
There's more than the fish.
There, well,
Johnny was his name.
Yeah.
some of the big reservoirs along the dams, if you ever get a chance to dive them, there can be amazing huge fish. stories of people settling down on what they thought was the bottom, and then the entire bottom movie. So you'd love it.
Oh, God.
Like, it's right up your alley.
Yeah.
That was a catfish.
Right. The listeners don't know that I instantly, like, tensed up when he said that.
Went into the semi-fetal position.
Right, that was terrifying. Yeah. All right.
So back to the early history of scientific diving in our state.
You avoided that question quite well. Go ahead.
1954, Friday Harbor Labs, Paul Sund, is really the first scientific diver in our area. And he mail-ordered his equipment. I think it was like an ad in the back of Popular Science or Popular Mechanics. He mail-ordered this stuff, and he got it there, and he's like, well, I got to figure out how to use this now.
Read the manual a couple times.
Right. And taught himself, was self-taught, and he's still alive. He lives in Anacortes,
that's
Washington,
terrifying.
And I've talked with him. He's a really interesting guy. He talks about the scientists at Friday Harbor Labs, which is associated with the University of Washington, and all the cool things that they had him do and things that he did for his research. So I got to mention him. So.
Maybe he'll listen to this podcast.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Throughout the 50s and 60s, diving, it was really a heyday.
Yeah, it was cool.
Yeah. Oh. And things started to change around the mid-70s. This is Captain Nathan Schwark from Shannon Point Marine Center. You are listening to KMRE LP 102.3 FM in Bellingham, your community, your voice, your station.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about scientific diving with Captain Nate Schwark. I was on a diving trip, I think it was in Manzanillo, Mexico, and there was like red tides all around, so we had to switch our diving locations, and we ended up going into this little cove area, and there was a bunch of sea stars that were like deteriorating. They were like lost limbs and stuff. Can you explain a little why that is? I think the divers there were blaming it on Fukushima or whatever it was, but I don't know. So
in our area, well, really the entire West Coast has been hit by what's called sea star wasting disease. So we actually have a professor at Western Washington University named Ben Miner who is looking into this sea star wasting disease. And he's collaborating with other scientists, some from University of Washington, some from the UC Santa Cruz system, one of them being his wife. But they've also sent up a team of divers to actually look in our area to see, is this happening in our area and how bad is it? So during fall of 2013 and then on into the winter of 2013-2014, this wasting disease hit right here. You may have heard of it, and it's been on the national news, but it caused one of the largest disease-related mortality events ever recorded in the ocean.
Wow.
So we have over 30 species of sea stars that live in our waters. So it's very diverse, and their impact on the ecology of the area is huge. And removing them from the area or having them no longer exist is a huge effect on the ecology of our area.
So here in Washington, there were sea stars that were deteriorating and limbs were falling.
Yes.
Like, what did it exactly look like?
Well, I call it melting.
Oh.
It's
awful.
There's some videos of at first some of their arms kind of curl up and are deformed, and then sometimes the arms will even detach themselves and crawl away from the main body. So, you know, their limbs exiting.
Like zombie movie.
Yes, exactly. And then the entire organism just kind of melts into this gelatinous ooze. It takes a while. They don't just happen overnight. It's like they're suffering. You know, I'm anthropomorphizing, but it really did look that bad.
And then, so this happened in 2013 and 2014, but is it still a problem or did it suddenly go away?
Well, that's one of the big questions.
Yeah.
Are they all dead?
Oh, right.
Are they coming back? Are we seeing any juveniles? Are we seeing any adults? So until recently, it had been almost a year since I had seen one of the adult sunflower stars. So one of the coolest, iconic species we have around here is this a giant sun star. And it's multi-rayed, lots of arms, and they get huge. And they used to be everywhere. You used to see them all the time. And they're an incredible predator. They can move fast. They can eat things. And we don't see adults anymore. The last survey dives I did with Dr. Miner, we saw some sub-adults. So not completely large, but there were some. And one of the ones we even saw still started to have some arms curling. So we're not even sure if they're going to live. But they're not all wiped out. There are still stars out there, but the diversity and the number is vastly decreased.
What did they find out what the cause of it was?
It looks like it's a virus. And one of the cool new projects, there's actually a Sea Grant proposal by three professors at Western, Dr. Ben Miner and Dr. Robin Codner, who's a molecular biologist, and then Dr. Sean Ariano. They've proposed this project to use a combination of field surveys and laboratory molecular techniques to answer some of those questions. So they can take planktonic larvae and sequence it on a DNA sequencer and tell what organism it's from. So you can collect plankton or collect larvae and tell, are there new sea star larvae out there in the water?
Right.
And is even that virus still present? So you can look for the presence of the virus.
Or did all the zombies not find brains and they're all dead now?
You're right.
Leave them on the island. That's a very sad thing, but it's maybe we can figure out what's happening. Let's go to a happier project that's being done at Shannon Point.
One of the really cool projects that's been ongoing for several years is the Pacific Northwest Native Abalone Restoration Efforts. And this is a collaborative project. There's a lot of groups. We have just a small piece of it, and there's a lot more going on. But there's groups like NOAA, the Puget Sound Restoration Fund, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, Department of Natural Resources, the Sea Doc Society, Skagit County Marine Resource Committee, the Port Townsend Marine Science Center, and the Jamestown Sklallam Tribe. I mean, there's all these groups collaborating, and one of the cool things about scientific diving is if they're all trained at the same level, they can all work together, dive together, which is a neat part of it, but not all of the project involves diving. But the pieces that we've been directly involved with, and there's many students at Western, graduate students mostly, that have been able to work on this, looking at larval and juvenile abalone outplanting. So
what's that
the
mean?
Story of abalone in Washington State is really fascinating. We have one species of abalone. They're a marine gastropod. So
and you,
a,
you
a
brought
really,
one, right?
You bet. Okay. You bet. I actually brought some babies, too.
Oh, well, I'm going to go grab
not
them.
Not live, the shells.
And we're going to take a picture of them and give them, show our listeners.
Sure. They're beautiful. You've probably seen abalone. It's used in jewelry. In fact,
Jordan has a belt.
Wearing a belt buckle, and it's got abalone on it. I did not do that on purpose.
No, well, it was accidental today.
And it's a traditional resource that was used by local Native Americans in their artwork, and so it has importance there. But the abalone that we have one species that are in Washington State, and what we're finding is that over the years we're seeing larger and larger individuals, but fewer of them. So we're not getting any new young recruits. There's no babies out there.
Except for the ones you brought in, right?
Well, we'll get to those.
That's a baby killer.
So
what they feel is happening is it has to do a lot with the life cycle of the abalone. And they actually release gametes into the water. So you have male abalone and female abalone, and they're releasing sperms and eggs into the water, and your fertilization's taking place. So, marine sex, gastropod sex.
Right.
Wow. And
that is the first time sex has been said on our show.
Right.
All right. I'm glad
you
I go
win.
Down on record.
You win. Yes.
So
this got all 50 shades in here.
Yeah.
Wave and water sex.
So it's not that exciting for abalone. They never actually
bring
come
it down
in physical contact with each other, but they need to be close to each other for fertilization to actually take place. And so if you have an abalone that's living over here on this rock and one's 5 feet away living on this rock and the current's going this direction, it's possible that nothing ever gets fertilized.
Right.
They need to be close together, you know, within a few feet.
So there needs
physically
to be
physically and mentally.
It's true.
And it's best at a full moon in
right.
June.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It pulls you together, right.
That's right. So the problem with this is that there wasn't very many, so they were too sparsely.
Yeah. Why wasn't there very many? What happened to them? Well,
yeah, what happened to them?
They're yummy. That's
And people make belts out of them, Jordan.
I actually just was talking to somebody the other day who said that they used to go down to the beach and they would just get them right off the off the rocks and just like feast on them.
Yes.
What? I've never had one. Have you?
Yeah.
Oh.
it was in Mexico somewhere.
And it was delicious?
Yeah.
Okay.
They are good.
Okay.
And so, I mean, they aggregate. So oftentimes at low tides, you could find several of them in the same area and collect a bunch of them. And so we think that that had an impact on it, is collection. And there was never really a commercial fishery for them, but there was a recreational fishery for them. We think there was an awful lot of poaching taking place.
Oh.
They're worth quite a bit of money, especially in Asian markets. And the shells also used for jewelry, so there's kind of a multi-benefit to having an adult organism.
Right.
So that's what we think took place. And so there's still adult abalone out there, but the aggregation sites aren't dense enough to be effectively reproducing and creating new baby abalone.
Right.
So what Fish and Wildlife and many of these other groups have done is go on a lot of dives in different areas where historically there was lots of abalone and find those few lone remaining adults that are getting larger and larger and not producing any babies and bring them back to a hatchery.
Okay.
And get them nice and close together and then we get tons of larval abalone.
So we're facilitating parties.
We are.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And that's good.
And then, so what do you do with these larvae? Do you try and raise them into subadults? Do you release the larvae back into the wild thinking that'll help? Or
I think you do like half-half, maybe. You release some of them, put them next to each other, hopefully some stick, and then you keep on doing this hatchery thing. I mean,
right.
This is Spark Science. I'm Regina Barber DeGraff.
And I'm Jordan Baker. If there's a science idea that you're curious about, send us an email or post a message on our Facebook page, Spark Science.
So one of the first projects that we were involved with at Shannon Point was actually outplanting juveniles. And
okay.
So you got to find good places. Where's going to be a good place to put these? There's not going to be a lot of predators, a lot of crabs and different things that are like, oh, look, all these baby abalone, yummy, yummy.
A lot of Jordans eating them.
Yeah, and if you look at one of the ones I brought in, you'll see that they're actually marked with little bumblebee tags on them. And so there's numbers on them.
Oh, my gosh,
and
they are.
Some of these.
Oh, look at that. I'm going to have to take a picture of that for our listeners, too, now.
Bumblebee tag?
Yeah.
There's numbers.
They're glued onto the top of the shell.
Oh.
So these juveniles are, you know, they're a couple centimeters less than an inch long. So outplanting lots of these in a specific area and then seeing if they will grow up and when they become reproductive, are they dense enough in that area to effectively reproduce?
Right.
And
that's
so that's,
how is it going so far? I mean, how long has the project been going?
They've been outplanted for, I think it's been 5-6 years is when this first started. And the last survey we were able to do on one of the outplant sites, they're still at a density that is great enough that we think there will be effective reproduction. So it's
awesome.
It seems to be going well. There's an effort that it takes to get them to the subadult, actually settle them down from the plankton in the hatchery. And so what would be easier is if we could just take larvae and shoot larvae out into the environment and see if that works. So there's been other projects where they'll take, you've seen like super soakers.
Yep.
And we have seen super soakers.
That's one of the best things to dive with is imagine your super soaker and you suck up a bunch of seawater that has thousands, maybe a million juvenile abalone in it, larvae.
Yeah.
And then you go underwater and you find a really good rocky reef area that you think, oh, they're going to love this place. You hit them with a chemical cue that causes them to decide, oh, I no longer want to be in the larval stage, or I would like to settle down and become benthic. And then shoot them out in this area underwater, and then hopefully they all settle down and when we come back in several years, we'll be able to see abalone there. So that's one of the more recent projects that's taken place. And
wow, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, some students that are able to
play with super soakers.
Yes,
for their major.
Yes.
And fertilize
for
things.
Science.
Yeah. Yeah. I eventually want to get to movies because that's my favorite thing ever to talk about. And, well, science, then movies. But so you were talking about earlier when we were off air about remote operated vehicles, ROV. I didn't know what it meant before you explained it to me. And and how you use those at Shannon Point and what programs are related to ROVs.
Sure, sure. One of the early projects we did was looking in areas locally for proposed marine protected areas. And, you know, these would be areas that are a no take, no fishing, no collecting. And then hopefully organisms in those areas would grow and develop and have lots of babies that would then spread out to other areas. And then the fishing and the shellfish would be better throughout the entire region. And surveying those areas was done by scientific divers.
Right. That's a lot of time.
Right. Well, and how do you know, looking above water, if that's going to be a good place to set aside as a marine protected area? You really need to send somebody down there, look at the relief. What is the bottom substrate? Is it sandy? Is it muddy? Is it rocky reef? And then look at the number of fish there. Is there even any fish at this area? Or maybe there's no fish there. So why are we protecting an area when there's no fish that live there? So divers do an excellent job at this, in my opinion. One of the other ways to get at that question is use an ROV. And if you've ever seen Titanic, at the beginning of Titanic, you'll see these really cool little robotic submarines that go down. They're tethered, so they're connected to the ship, sending a video feed, and you can manipulate our arms. They send them down great depths, and you can see the bottom.
Right.
So why would we send a diver when you could just send an ROV?
Right. And it's less dangerous.
Well, yes, yes. If you consider diving dangerous,
I'm sure you could get more information if you're down there longer, right? Without having to be down there.
And go to greater depths.
Yeah.
So the ROV we have at Shannon Point can reach a depth of 300 feet.
Oh wow!
I've never dove to 300 feet, so that's what's down there. That's awesome. Let's see what's down there.
Yeah. Well, you just said Titanic and James Cameron. He puts a lot of money into these devices, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
the thing that was the ROV that was in Titanic, how deep can it go? Do you know?
Thousands of feet.
Wow.
Yeah.
That brings us to, let's talk about movies. Let's talk about inaccuracies. So one, was the ROV in Titanic, was that all believable?
Oh, like, yeah. Okay. It was a beautiful ROV.
Oh, okay. Okay. Well, that's good.
And the pilot, because ROV operators love to be referred to as pilots.
is this an ego thing?
So if you're a drone operator, you're a pilot.
So yeah, I thought they did a good job with that.
Yeah.
Did they actually go down and look at the actual Titanic?
Oh, yes.
That was in the movie?
So it was real footage.
I believe so.
Awesome.
Wow. So we were talking about The Abyss, which still I have not seen. And we were talking about it in the volcano show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were trying to get, like, in the labs, they were trying to get mice to breed, like, sort of an amniotic fluid. And I actually found out that they were still testing that for humans. And how do you know how far they've gotten with that?
I don't. It's not my area of expertise. But it sounds cool. So it's a high oxygen solution that you're actually taking into your lungs, and your lungs are able to absorb oxygen from the solution.
Yeah.
And
would
so
you
that,
do it?
Probably not at this stage of my life.
Okay.
Maybe once my family is grown and I don't have as much to lose.
He'll be a tester then.
Do you think the science behind the idea is sound? Or
I'm sure there is legitimate science behind the idea.
Okay.
I was watching Shark Week, which I am addicted to every year. So they were talking about a bunch of reserves or things where they think that shark breeding happens.
I see.
And so I just wanted to really relate that to what you were saying about the shellfish. And
right.
It's not just shellfish, but it's, you know, other species as well.
Yeah. And sharks are an important part of the ecosystem, and a lot of parts of the world love to eat parts of them, so
that's true.
Also, there was an ROV that they had attached. It was a remote thing that they attached to the dorsal fin of the shark, and it followed the shark.
Oh, cool.
And it was cool to
so
see
study the behavior.
Yeah, I was just watching where it went and stuff. Cool. Have you heard about those ROVs?
Well, I know there's critter cams. It's not quite an ROV in that it's autonomous. It's not being manipulated directly.
Okay.
Sure.
But yeah, you know, critter cams, you get amazing footage from them that you probably would never get any other way. So
before we move away from sharks, though, I'm so happy, Jordan, that you brought up sharks, because my favorite ocean movie is Deep Blue Sea with LL Cool J. It's about sharks that have been bred to have brains that are very, very smart. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Is this one where LL Cool J's a cook?
Yes.
It's sort of like a Steven Seagal.
Yes. And Samuel L. Jackson is doing this like really, really inspiring speech. And then there's a section in the room that he's doing the speech where like it's a pool. And then at the end of his, we can do this, we're going to all live, like the shark comes up. Sorry, spoiler alert. Comes up and just out of the water kills him and then takes him back in.
Well, this isn't a normal shark. This is a genetically
engineered
shark.
Yeah, he's smart. He's smart, right?
Smart.
But if you haven't seen that yet, for our listeners, it's a terrible, great movie.
No, I think a really great movie out there with sharks is Sharknado 1, Sharknado 2.
3's coming out.
Yeah, Sharknado 3 is soon to be out.
But see, I think Captain Nate would not be...
That's real science. That's,
yeah, I think Captain Nate would not be interested in that, not because it's terrible, but because the sharks are not in the water in Sharknado. Right. They're in tornadoes. He's interested in the ocean.
Right.
Well, and we have some really cool sharks in our area.
Do we really?
Yes.
Bring it back to normal.
So one of the cool things, and if you've ever been to Seattle Aquarium, they focus on this somewhat, is the six-gill sharks. So they're considered more of a prehistoric shark. They're often deep water.
Wow.
They're pretty slow, kind of lethargic, but you can actually dive and see these. Sometimes they'll come up within diving depths. They're slow, they're large.
They don't bite you?
16 feet. Well, I have no documented case of a diver getting bitten by a six-gill shark. It's actually kind of a tourist activity to go and try and find them.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of sharks. I'm just afraid of everything else in the ocean, which makes no sense.
And then we have lots of what are called dogfish.
Right, yes. Right.
Locally, you know, small. You know, they can be 30-some years old and only a few feet long.
Right.
And they're an important part of the local ecosystem as well. So yeah.
Are the six-gill as aggressive as the seven-gill? I just watched a documentary with the seven-gill, how they were testing like the aggressiveness and how they were starting to pack hunt and stuff. So.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
No,
cool.
I do not like believe the six-gill are aggressive. So, one of the things is unique about them is they're very limber. They don't have quite as pronounced dorsal fin. They can actually kind of turn and bite their own tail.
Oh, wow.
So like a dog.
Right. So
when it's approaching you, you know, you have like jaws and like, dunna, dunna, and you can see the fin. It's not really like that, is what you're saying.
Not really like that.
So is it more stubby?
Blunt and, yeah.
Right.
Still, anytime you see something that large underwater, your heart rate starts to go.
I'm afraid of whales that apparently are not terrifying, but I'm just
you're
like, they're so big.
Of seaweed.
I'm seeing seaweed. Right?
Well, and we're lucky our local pods, the resident orca whales that live in our area, really do not like seals. They eat fish. It's the transient whales that hunt seals.
Right.
And so I'm glad of that because there's been diving in areas where I've heard killer whales underwater. And I would not really like to come face to face with one of them. So
no.
Oh, so you're saying that you and your outfit look like a seal.
Yeah.
So therefore, our local orca whales are not going to murder you.
Hopefully not. Okay. They're more interested in the salmon that's swimming out in the open water.
Just put in your scuba suit, you know, salmon. So you're just like, you just throw it. You know, like dogs coming after you.
So
you throw sausages.
You're
going to chum
himself. A big piece of bait.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to find, it's like a dog coming up to you, knowing that you got a treat in your pocket.
You don't have to take my advice. I don't even go in the ocean, so... All right, well, I want to thank you, Captain Nate Schwark, to coming to talk to us and dealing with our ridiculousness. We learned a lot. I actually learned a lot about scientific diving, so thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I enjoyed being here.
This is Spark Science. I'm Regina Barber DeGraff.
And I'm Jordan Baker. We'll be back again next week. Listen to us Sunday at 5 p.m., Wednesday at 9 p.m., and Saturday at noon.
If there's a science idea that you're curious about, send us an email or post a message on our Facebook page, Spark Science. If you liked our show and would like to support us, please go to KMRE.org and click on the button Donate. Today's episode, Scuba Science, was produced in the KMRE Spark Radio Studios, located in the Spark Museum on Bay Street in Bellingham. Our producer and engineer is Suzanne Blaze.
Our theme music is Chemical Calisthenics by Blackalicious. Our feature song today is Stella Was a Diver by Interpol.
Then you add a little talent in.
Careful with those ingredients. They can explode and blow up if you drop them and they hit the ground.